dig it?
Yeah, I can dig it, yeah.
He's got classic soul. He's okay, I can't think of anything else, but he's got classic soul. Tune in on Sunday mornings, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m.
Soul Central Station with Tony Ryan.
99.5 WBAI.
Hi, this is Kalia Washington, inviting you to Waseckum University this Sunday, January 24th at 3 p.m., located at 271 South 9th Street in Newark, New Jersey. For my lecture and forecast, our theme is It's Time to Heal. That's this Sunday, January 24th at Waseckum University, 271 South 9th Street in Newark, New Jersey. For contact information, 973-444-3144. That's 973-444-3144. Hope to see you there.
Can we change the world?
This is Ray Corona inviting you to an amazing concert featuring the Lavender Light Gospel Choir and Emma's Revolution, with special appearances by other great musicians. The People's Music Network and the New York Society for Ethical Culture will present this concert on Friday, January 29th at 7:30 p.m. at 2 West 64th Street at Central Park West. Tickets at the door or in advance from tinyurl.com/PMN tickets or call 718-788-4214.
And you tune into listener supported WBAI New York 99.5 FM, your peace and justice radio station. I have to apologize. Up next is Ethics on Air, New York Society for Ethical Culture. I'm very sorry about that. And that's coming up at 11 a.m. right here on your listener supported station, WBAI 99.5 FM.
This is Ethics on the Air, brought to you by the New York Society for Ethical Culture. Good morning. I'm Dr. Phyllis Harrison Ross, and I'm here today with our regular host, Dr. Terry Perlin, and Tiberio Gallus, Managing Director of the Auschwitz Institute for Peace and Reconciliation. You can expect me to murder that name. Good morning. Okay. Today we would like to discuss the work that the Auschwitz Institute for Peace and Reconciliation is doing to foster conflict prevention through education and training. We will discuss the part we can all play in ending genocide worldwide, and the importance of promoting ethical behavior here at home as well as beyond our borders. Now, through his work at the Auschwitz Institute for Peace and Reconciliation, Tiberio, and can I call you Tibby?
Oh, please do.
Tibby, okay. Tibby has developed this small nonprofit with its vision of making the world a better place into a major force in the international movement to combat genocide. Now, we all know about genocide, where we see people being killed, where we see people having to have babies that belong to other races. And we see some long-term genocidal effects in places like Haiti, and I want to discuss that. Hopefully we'll have some time to take that on. Tibby, please tell us about the Institute. What is its mission? Maybe describe a little bit about its background.
Yes, of course. Well, the Auschwitz Institute, the way we call it usually AIPR to make things easier, is a not-for-profit that is coming from here, from the U.S., from New York, and from Poland, from the town of Auschwitz, or Świecim, as it is called in Polish. And our mission is to help genocide prevention in the entire world. We have what we think a somewhat new approach to genocide prevention, in the sense that we reach out at elite level, helping governments, important actors in genocide prevention, to get familiarized with policy options that they have to prevent genocide on the long term, also on the short term, at home and in other societies. We are very concerned with reaching those people who can be very important in taking decisions that can deter a genocide from happening. We do this in several ways, one of them being that we organize seminars for mid-level government officials from the entire world, both from developing and developed countries, both from countries with a high risk of genocide happening in the near future and from countries with virtually no risk of genocide happening in the near future, in Auschwitz in Poland. We count very much on sensitizing both their minds and their hearts about the importance of genocide happening. That's why the site of Auschwitz, where Europe has experienced its largest genocide, is very important, and we can show our participants from the entire world that genocide endures. 60 years on, more than 60 years on, actually, at this point, the legacy of genocide is still present, affecting communities, urban communities, state communities, and it is a space where one experiences the loss that both perpetrators, victims, and bystanders and descendants of them experience. So this is the sensitizing the heart part and seeing how things happen, but we also engage with the mind and bring experts from the entire world, policymakers, academics, to talk about what's new in genocide prevention policy and how can genocide...
What's new?
Exactly. How genocide prevention can become part of their daily work.
I'm glad that you talked about present issues. Certainly that's very important. There's no doubt that the phrase itself, Auschwitz or Auschwitz-Birkenau, has enormous emotional as well as intellectual clout. It's been discussed in fields from theology. I think it was Elie Wiesel who said or claimed that God died at Auschwitz, to particular issues, say in Africa, for example, or even some might say historically in the United States, genocide being an accusation regarding our policy or our actions towards Native Americans. I guess the more general question I wanted to ask you is this. We may try to prevent mass murder on the basis of race or other forms of discrimination, and sometimes we hope we'll be successful, but will we ever know that we are successful? The way in which we evaluate genocide is almost always by hindsight, by looking back to the 1930s and 1940s, or looking back to the 19th century. How do you know if it's working?
That's one of the issues we face. If our work is done properly, nothing happens. So the ultimate goal of our work is actually a lack of action. It's very difficult to demonstrate something that results in non-action. We believe, though, that through healthy policy directed towards genocide prevention, actually there are more gains that society experiences than just the lack of violence or mass crimes.
For example,
we work with different approaches to genocide prevention, ranging from legal, political, economic measures that can be taken. The basis of genocide prevention policy and mass crime prevention policy really is good governance. So increasing the quality of good governance in a society has major benefits for that society, aside from it being kept together and not falling apart as a result of genocide.
Now, that sounds a little bit like a policy that was established a long time ago, and then most recently during the Bush administration here, the assumption that democratization somehow, particularly in the Middle East, would lead to a diminution of violence. I don't know if that's proven or not. Is that what you're saying? Or is it good government a more, shall we say, widely descriptive term than simply democratic action?
Well, personally, I do actually greatly believe in the values of democracy, but not in values of democracy as it is imposed, a model or the other. Democracy actually, from our experience working with government officials, means being responsive to the needs of the society that you govern. Sometimes some of those needs might result in what in one society or the other could emerge as being non-democratic in the jargon, in the Western jargon. What we advocate is attention to the needs of society and true engagement of government with cultural, social, and economic rights, the way they take shape in that society and not in a normative, imposed manner that would come from an enlightened elite.
Do you emphasize all aspects of the people in a given location? In other words, if you have different cultural groups or may be subjugating one another, but they all belong to the same country.
It's in many times in pre-genocidal situation, it is a conflict between groups as they define themselves or as one group defines the two groups. Mm-hmm. So we really emphasize that for government to be engaged with basically all the needs of each of the groups and to involve into decision making the groups that are oppressed or feel oppressed. This many times results in situations that don't make anybody happy, in compromises, in what they call Belgian compromises. Everybody walks away from the table slightly unsatisfied, but at the same time being willing to work together for a while.
To stay part of, no one is mutinied, actually. They'll stay part of the process.
Exactly, right? Mm-hmm. Exactly. Staying part of the process and deepening the process is what genocide prevention is about. I also believe that genocide prevention, through this process of communication, ends up in making everyday lives better. Many times deepening the process results in actual good local politics. For example, in case of situations like Bosnia, deepening the process might result in facilitating communication between different parts of a town, reestablishing a history of cultural engagement between parts of society. Many times these cultural aspects, local aspects, underpin the great, very TV-friendly moments of politicians agreeing in a society.
One of the questions I had is about the term itself, and I perhaps have used or abused it myself. I described the Native American situation in the United States, and others would have a different perspective. It is a loaded term in some ways. Would you agree? I mean, it's certainly not morally neutral.
It is not, and it is a term that we also, as an organization working in the field, struggle with, because a genocide is a genocide most of the time, the way it is perceived legally, only after it happens. So what we emphasize very much with our partners is that genocide is a process that starts very early on through discriminatory politics, through jokes, through everyday interaction. Genocide is seeded in human interaction on the street, and it's not a purely political action. You might be familiar, in the genocide studies communities, every person has his or her own definition of genocide.
That was going to be my question. Give me a couple of definitions of genocide.
Well, the one that everybody relates to is the one from the Genocide Convention, and that has lots of problems. I actually brought it with myself.
That's the convention after World War II?
It is, it yes. is. Right. And that one states that in the convention, genocide means any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group as such. And then it enumerates a few ways of doing this. Killing members of the group, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group and forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. And this definition is problematic because it lumps together very different actions. Many times they happen at the same time in a given genocide.
I want to continue with this because, again, I'm thinking about Haiti,
right?
With all of that definition, but I do want to say that you are listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York, streaming live worldwide at WBAI.org, and I'm Dr. Phyllis Harrison Ross, and here today with co-host Dr. Terry Perlin, in conversation with Tibby Gallis, Managing Director of the Auschwitz Institute for Peace and Reconciliation. So can we just kind of continue with the getting that definition of what genocide is?
Of course, yes. Of course. What the problem with this definition is that it is a post-factum definition. It doesn't really help you to prevent genocide. It describes some of the dynamics in genocides. What I use as my personal definition of genocide that helps of thinking about it as a process is genocides and politicides are the promotion, execution, or implied consent of sustained policies by governing elites or their agents, or in the case of civil war, either of the contending authorities, policies that are intended to destroy in whole or in part a communal, political, or politicized ethnic group. This is, of course, it's not my definition, it's Barbara Harve's definition. And I relate to this because the widely used definition does neglect such important groups as political groups. And that was, of course, the result of a historical lack of consensus in the elaboration of the convention at the beginning of the Cold War, with both the United States and the USSR not agreeing for political groups to be covered by the convention.
So that, for example, in Indonesia, the liquidation of the left, of the Communist Party, would, by the conventional definition, not be included. But you certainly do include it.
We do include it. We also include, of course, by the definition, the dirty war in Argentina would not qualify as a politicized genocide. But by our standards, we also aim for policies that prevent events like the dirty war.
And certainly the mothers and the grandmothers who are still walking in the plaza on Thursdays, I witnessed them not so long ago in Buenos Aires, would testify that this was not only genocidal, but that it was never sufficiently answered to either.
Indeed.
That leads me to the other part of the title of your organization. It's not just genocide or the Auschwitz Institute for Peace, but also reconciliation. We have some interesting role models for that. The best known probably is in South Africa. Now there's a new movie out called Invictus, in which Nelson Mandela is portrayed by Morgan Freeman very beautifully. Even in the state of South Carolina, there's a reconciliation commission at the moment to try to get people together around issues of slavery and then of the post-Civil War period.
And it works.
It does work.
It's working.
It's a difficult and long process, and it certainly aims to do it in a nonviolent way. Is peace and reconciliation two sides of the same coin? Is that how you see it?
We do see peace and reconciliation going together. Reconciliation, one of the likeliest places for a genocide to happen is a place where something similar to genocide has already happened. So reconciliation plays a great role in the process of avoiding bad things from happening again.
Because people identify with the aggressor, as we say.
Indeed. And circles of aggression emerge. I say this, though, with a caveat. Reconciliation is widely used these days as a term that somehow talks about peaceful living together. I believe that reconciliation is much more than that. It means somehow addressing through generations the issue and basically making it part of peaceful interaction and lack of conflict, of violent conflict. And that's never an event that happens in a month or two. It's an event that many times takes 60 years or 100 of years to happen, and is down to each individual to deal with the process. Again, this is I'm many times stating my personal opinions. The Auschwitz Institute does not actually, through its work, give recipes for preventing genocide. Our work is very much concentrated on bringing together experts who have many times contradictory opinions and presenting policymakers options for what they can do. And actually, what we very much emphasize is we alert our policymakers about their role in developing their own solutions.
Because so your mission is dialogic as opposed to didactic. Would it be fair to say that?
Yes. We try to avoid being didactic.
That's pretty heavy. What's dialogic?
You want to talk to one another as opposed to punch someone out and tell them what to do. How's that for a euphemism?
Okay.
I don't think you have much choice. And if you're in favor of peace, it's pretty hard to associate yourself with, you better do it or else. But I think from the point of such dialogues, I know you have programs literally on site in Auschwitz. Is that true?
Indeed.
And you've done it with the State Museum there?
We've organized it with our great partner, the State Museum, Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum. Their support has been invaluable. And we very much believe that the site is very important for the process we have, because spending a week in Auschwitz for people from the entire world brings reality to the experience and the legacy of genocide. And not only through the museum itself, the camps. I believe that their experience is greatly influenced also by the town of Oświęcim, which is next, and Krakow. This entire geographical area that has experienced genocide and presents different ways of dealing with it. Also, the behavior of the people who visit the camp, Auschwitz-Birkenau, is actually very interesting for our participants, and it helps them understand how people relate to a genocide that's passed and how this can actually have an impact on them and their societies.
Can you tell me, I can certainly understand why peace and reconciliation would go on in South Africa, but why would, say, a country like the United States want to be involved in genocide prevention and peace and reconciliation? I mean, do they acknowledge that, do these well-developed countries acknowledge that may still be a potential in their countries?
From our approach to history, we learned that it's not countries that have obvious problems at times are the only ones that have a short or medium or long-term risk of genocide. Every society can develop, unfortunately, genocidal dynamics. Of course, assessing situations, for example, in the United States, a genocide is not likely to occur any day in the near future. Nonetheless, the United States can and its policymakers greatly influence what's happening in many of the societies that we deal with and that are at high risk. Further, also at the domestic level, I believe that genocide prevention is a frame that allows for improving existing governments, even though they are highly functional. Genocide prevention mindset for a public servant helps one to focus on those things that make interconnectedness actually influence policy and make life better for their own citizens at home. I believe U.S. government officials, and we've had great participation from the State Department, and we are very happy about that. Great. It actually helps them also emphasize those aspects of American society, those policies that can make life better and prevent the risk of any communities feeling dissatisfied with their public life.
You know, recently in this past week, there have been some dramatic things happening, an unexpected election result in Massachusetts.
Right.
And the Supreme Court had made a big decision yesterday that many people on the cable talk, you know, yell and scream and yell fire networks are talking about. And I am just wondering, should we be about some peace and reconciliation here, thinking about that? And do you think of it in terms of involving the media?
Peace and reconciliation is, again, a way of dealing with the past. I believe every society has experienced traumatic past episodes of strife and conflict. And peace and reconciliation dealing with those issues is essential. It does not necessarily take the shape of an institution, but through public policy, people can address this. Our politicians can address this constructively.
Can I shift that just slightly? There's no doubt.
Terry, maybe can you hold your questions so
it's time for a non-commercial break?
We can have another little commercial break to tell our listeners that they're listening to Ethics on the Air on WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York, streaming live on WBAI.org. And I'm Dr. Phyllis Harrison Ross and Dr. Terry Perlin from the New York Society for Ethical Culture. And we're here in conversation with Tibby Gallus, who's the managing director of the Auschwitz Institute for Peace and Reconciliation. And Terry had a really excellent question that was coming
first,
up.
Phyllis, we might tell our listeners that lines will be open in the last 20 minutes of our show, so we encourage you to call. What's the number?
The number is at area code 212-209-2900, and please get your pens out and write your questions down, because this is really some good stuff.
If we look back to the Second World War, there's no doubt that there were perpetrators, and certainly there were victims, but there were also people who looked the other way. I'm not only thinking of individuals, but whole states. Some states, or at least some representatives of states, were more assertive in trying to help those who might have become victims. I know that you were born in Romania, just
yes.
on the border of Hungary. Hungary is well known as a place that saved many, not all, of course. The same would be true of Norway. But if we look at France, for example, or even the Netherlands, the savior, so to speak, of Anne Frank died only last week. We know that in those particular nations, many people looked the other way as Jews and other subject peoples were sent to Auschwitz and Birkenau, etc. Is it fair to say today that we have the same sort of situation? Even very powerful countries have turned to either come on board late or have looked the other way. I'm thinking of the ethnic cleansing of the former Yugoslavia during the
right.
Bill Clinton administration. How do we deal with not just assertive, aggressive behavior, but those who are witness but who will refuse for many reasons, including domestic politics, to become involved?
We noticed that, unfortunately, our governments are more likely to fail those who are in danger of being victims of genocide than to actually help them escape that. And that, unfortunately, is a history of many democratic states that claim that they have the duty to also protect citizens who are innocent victims of genocide in other countries. And that's the rule, unfortunately. And our action is actually meant to change this rule and to challenge it. We do believe that failure was not actually the consequence of lack of a wish to save people. Failure is the consequence of overburdening of government by many issues and by their limited responsibility towards the citizens of our other nations. What we do is trying to help them assert in their minds and through their work, developing a habit of actually thinking about what their actions, the action of their government, has as an impact on citizens of our nations, and when things get nasty, to actually prioritize those who are about to be victims of a genocide as people who they have a duty towards. This happens in many ways, them learning ways how you can actually deal with genocide. Most of the time our participants talk, and people who have experienced genocide, they say that the first reaction when things go very bad is that you cannot do anything. People react to genocide developing to a natural catastrophe. They do not see it as a human action. Humanizing the process is very important, and giving agency to people who were put there to actually impact on it is part of what we do. And then also realizing that everybody's actually at a loss in genocide, perpetrators, victims, and bystanders.
You must, I won't say be dependent upon, but must be, how shall we say, very encouraging of on-site reports of mass violence, for example. But governments have learned, including our own, that the way you manage that is by, for example, embedding journalists with the so-called good guys and not looking at it from the other perspective. There was a deep criticism of the Israeli incursion into the Gaza last year because essentially it was a news blackout. Journalists were only allowed to come in after the fact of the death of about 1,100, including many women and children. Is there any solution to this, especially since we live in an internet-engaged age where we can rely upon participants or even potential victims to use their cell phones and the cameras and their small video equipment to get stuff to us right away without necessarily being censored by the government?
I believe, yes, of course there is a solution. The multiple channels of communication existing at the present are amazing. Nonetheless, they also result in something that you've already mentioned, an overburdening with information.
Yes.
Primary information is abundant, but we still rely on secondarily transmitted information that comes through media and government outlets. So one way to actually for civil servants is to rely on different networks of information gathering and actually use the secondary information and primary information and connect that to the story of the society that they are working with.
We want to continue with this, but we're going to have a station break at this time. And to tell our audience that they are listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM, streaming live on WBAI.org, and we'll be back in a moment. Get your pencils out. Stay tuned for this very important program.
On Tuesday, January 26, Revolution Books will host a forum, Why So Many People Died in the Earthquake and Why the U.S. Can Do No Good in Haiti. It will probe what lies behind the criminal refusal by the U.S. government to provide serious aid or even allow the Haitian people to escape the devastated island. Speakers include writers from Revolution newspaper, Leon Estow and Carl Dix. The event takes place at 7 p.m. on Tuesday, January 26 at Revolution Books, 146 West 26th Street. For more information, call 212-691-3345. That's 212-691-3345.
This is Phil Donahue. I have 600 channels in my home, but 400 of them are selling the Bowflex machine. That's why I listen to WBAI New York.
You're listening to Ethics on the Air on WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York and streaming live on WBAI.org. I'm Dr. Phyllis Harrison Ross, and I'm here with co-host Dr. Terry Perlin, and we're in conversation with Tibby Gallis, Managing Director of the Auschwitz Institute for Peace and Reconciliation. In about 5 minutes, we're going to start taking your calls and let you know that that number is 212-209-2900. We certainly, when we stopped, we were just talking about what the citizens and the organizations that are trying to prevent genocide, immediate genocide, medium genocide, long-range genocide, how they can utilize all the information that is possible and how they can prioritize it because it's coming at us at a furious pace.
Continuing on that, it's we have to be also aware that in our programs we deal primarily with government officials. One solution to this overflow of information is also what we establish through these seminars is a network, a growing network of civil servants coming from a variety of states. We have former participants ranging from Cambodia, China, all the way to the United States, going through Europe, DRC, South Africa, to Argentina, who stay in contact, and we encourage them to actually share the information. Many times, the secondary information that's mediated by government and by media is very different when it reaches society because it also serves the function of satisfying the needs of the society where it is heard. But as a result of that, through practice, we've also noticed that many of our participants hear different stories about the same event, but through communication among them and having as a consensus the need to protect human life, they do get to a grain of information that is reflective of what societies, what's happening in conflict societies. Further, we have the example of one of our participants from Burundi that has been experiencing strife for many years now, and part of her attempt to nationally receive accurate information was setting up networks using cell phone technology and streaming of cell phone filmed films, small films transmitted through the internet or through cell phones to get an accurate picture of what's happening in the different parts of Burundi.
That's very encouraging. This is Ethics on the Air, of course, and both Dr. Harrison Ross and I are fervent members of the New York Society for Ethical Culture, so if you'll allow it, I'm going to ask you a kind of morality ethics question as well. What we're dealing with in the short and long term in terms of behavior are remarkably horrific acts of aggression, of mass violence. Daniel Jonah Goldhagen wrote a book 15 years ago called Hitler's Willing Executioners, in which he alleged from a kind of social psychological perspective that in this case the Germans and their allies in other Eastern European countries were just waiting to kill all the Jews that they could. Now, it's a very controversial book, though he did win a prize in Berlin for writing it. But it asserts that it may not be human nature, it may be human nature cultivated by nationalism or xenophobia, that many of us are just waiting to wipe out difference. And I wonder if you saw it that way, and if it is that way, not that we don't want to be utopian in our aspirations, but if we're all potential life threateners of others and therefore live in a conflict of each against the other, whether there's ever going to be a positive outcome to trying to deal with this kind of innate, as Freud would say, aggressive instinct.
Framing it from the perspective of ethical systems, I do not personally believe that people are just ready to kill people. Many times it's actually very difficult from studying the actions of perpetrator regimes, it is really difficult to mobilize people to kill other people. Nonetheless, many times this action is helped by indoctrination and by espousing what seems to be an ethical system that serves the nation, serves the country. Most perpetrators do believe when they are when they are committing genocide, that they do a good thing.
You know, one of my professors when I was studying psychiatry said once that he felt the only solution to this was miscegenation. In other words, that we mutually destroy each other by getting together and producing a new option.
It is very scary how everything gets validated in these systems of thought that actually promote destruction as the only solution for sorting out problems. Nonetheless, what we try to help with is to create a system of thought that puts as central the value of human life, and that any action that brings that into peril is scrutinized incredibly, because we have not yet experienced a situation in which destruction resulted in anything good for anybody involved.
Of course, there are different ways of, I don't want to sound too negative, of killing. At Birkenau, it was, as some would call it, industrialized. Very face-to-face. In other situations, it's done by high-altitude bombing of civilian populations. Do you think it makes a difference? That is to say, for the perpetrator to have to literally be on site, looking at the eyes of the so-called enemy or person to be exterminated, versus the kind of long distance, I'm thinking of the drones that we're using, for example, in Afghanistan, which have killed lots of civilians. Is there somehow a post-industrialized way of killing that we haven't given sufficient consideration to?
From the perspective of the victim, it makes no difference whether the killing is done by hand or by remote. For the end result is death. So that's very clear. From the perspective of the perpetrator, it does make a difference whether the ones enacting genocide need to look into the eyes of the victim or not. Even in early industrialized killing, the regimes made all possible efforts to make killing a process that did not even involve direct contact. It seems that helps mostly cultures from the West, helps them enact killing without thinking too much.
I'm also thinking about some unconscious genocidal activities, such as allowing the Haitians to just to get into these little boats and sail out into the ocean and turn them away so that they end up drowning, but we didn't really do it. We just never really facilitated them getting to this country as immigrants.
It is many actions, many public actions have very, very bad effects. And that's why making our civil servants responsive to the consequences, potential negative consequences of their actions, is what we see important. The boats people from the earlier stages, that we have seen something like this happen 40 years ago, and it again, nothing happened. So it's a very, very, history shows us that neglect is many times a way of enacting bad policies that result in death of citizens.
Tibby, you work in a field where one could become clinically depressed in a second, yet you seem a very upbeat and positive and, I would say, enthusiastic young man. What keeps hope alive for you?
Well, I've actually, and I am going to speak into the microphone and not keep on turning around now. What for us working in the field of genocide prevention and studying before genocide studies helps is, to a certain extent, hope that what we do has an impact and that it actually helps people live their lives and live their lives better. Nonetheless, it's sometimes, to be candid, it is very, very, very difficult to deal with these situations.
You certainly have to adjust your expectations to the situation, I think, and set your goals where they should be, and that way you don't get as disappointed if they don't succeed. I'm going to tell our audience again that they're listening to Ethics on the Air on WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. I'm Dr. Phyllis Harrison Ross here with co-host Dr. Terry Perlin, and we're in conversation with Tibby Gallus, Managing Director of the Auschwitz Institute for Peace and Reconciliation. And we really would like to have your calls. So we are going to open our lines now and see if we have some calls. To remind you, the number is 212-209-2900.
And we have Hello. A first caller.
Yes. Hello, Ethics.
Good morning, Ethics on the Air.
Yes.
Hi. My question is, how do progressives participate in Truth and Reconciliation commissions in places like Iraq and Eastern Europe, where progressives and leftists actually aided and abetted the mass murderers and rapists? How is that done, considering a lot of leftists actually backed it? And please don't deny it. My question is, how much blood is on your hands?
On my hands, there's yes. no blood.
Oh, really?
I can show that to you had we had a screen. But
as we know, you don't have to be the killer to actually take responsibility for it, as you did. If I back a fascist movement across the world, am I completely clean?
Let's let him answer the question, and then
I'm very glad you brought this question, because you actually point to one of the things that we are very often neglecting, is that perpetrators can come from very diverse ideologies. Many times what seems as a progressive movement, or as is presented a progressive movement to a certain society, can have genocidal policies. And to be candid, everybody is affected by a genocide wherever it happens, most of the time, even without knowing it. I personally come from Eastern Europe, and having my personal history, I'm very sensitive to the left-encouraged political cleansing that happened there. One of the things that we have learned in dealing with regimes that are post-political conflict, post-regime abuse, post-war, is that everybody has to participate in a peace and reconciliation process. This peace and reconciliation doesn't mean the clean, nice thing that we sometimes look at. It's not everybody hugging everybody. It means some very creative dealing with political institutions. It means justice, and it means also satisfying the needs of the victims. It also means reintegrating perpetrators into society and not allowing them be a disgruntled group that will bring again crimes into that society. I hope this answers somehow your question.
Tibby, I'm so glad that you pointed out that, as I understand it, from your perspective, you're politically neutral in the sense that you oppose violence left, right, and center. And I think the greatest scholars suggested that as well. Most of us know about Hannah Arendt's book, The Origins of Totalitarianism. We tend to focus on the fascist or Nazi dimensions of it, but it was a book about Stalinism as well. And the argument there was that there's a tremendous similarity or parallel between the kind of centralized totalitarian genocidal policies of left regimes as well as right regimes.
We have another call. Hello, you're on the air. Hello?
Hello?
Yes. Uh-huh. Hello? Yes. Hello.
Yeah, hi, how are you? First, I have a comment, and it is that yesterday when I was watching the news from Haiti, I really felt that I was in a very impotent situation witnessing the genocide in Haiti. That's, I don't know if the way you define it previously, you can call that genocide, but was the only thing I could think of. And the other thing, and I'm from Argentina, so I live there, and I know, you know, what you were talking about before. And my question is that I always thought very important Spanish is autodeterminación de los pueblos. In
yes.
English, I will call it autodetermination of the nations. And it is, when do you decide when another nation can intervene or help, or how much, and where is the line crossed where you are like doing more than just helping and maybe taking advantage? And how can you really say when somebody else can come from another nation and intervene? You know, like we have what's going on in Iraq, and they're like, you know, many, many cases in our history.
Right. In related to the situation in Haiti, I would not call what's happening now a genocide, because it is a natural catastrophe that has impacted on a society. I believe that it can have implications on future political situation that could be very harmful. And also the history of Haiti has, recent history, has experienced lots of negative political dynamics that could result in group destroying several groups. Nonetheless, what you mentioned about self-determination of the peoples, of nations, and about sovereignty mostly, is whether another society has the possibility to intervene in genocidal dynamics in a different society. I believe that even based on the weak legal framework we have currently, which is the Genocide Convention and the emerging issues of responsibility to protect, our societies have not only the mandate but the obligation to intervene in one way or the other to protect possible victims of genocide.
Is this based upon international conventions on human rights? Is that the perspective you're speaking of?
The perspective I'm speaking of is international the Genocide Convention,
yes,
to which most UN members are signatories. Also, human rights, the system of human rights, also conventions on terror and torture. Exactly.
Right.
They give a legal backing to intervention. What I have to explain here is that intervention does not mean that the military goes in and that it cleans up the place and puts order there.
Blue helmets.
But we also have some sneaky ways of going in and
intervention.
And impacting.
Intervention means also diplomatic, concerted diplomatic intervention, addressing the needs, sometimes the very self-interested needs of the actors who are involved in genocide. Genocide is many times the result of structural inequalities, and some of the actors can tilt the way that genocide is happening.
You just have to keep your eye on people not getting killed,
and that's the
point. I know we have some more callers, and I want to be sure that we give more people opportunity. Hello, Ethics on the Air.
Hi. I was wondering, I know a professor did teach about Hitler and his speeches and was reprimanded for that, but I was wondering if it would be beneficial to actually study all of these leaders and their histories, their growing up, their behaviors, and see how they speak and if that would be beneficial to the peaceful nations, so that perhaps there are similarities between them.
Yes, there are currently studies, and there have been, especially after the Second World War and in the early phases of the Cold War, there have been lots of studies about the behavior, the discourse of charismatic leaders that push citizens towards violence. And what we have learned from this is that genocidal language is very similar from one society to the other. Whether, as it was in the case of Germany, the potential victims are called vermin. In Rwanda, they were called cockroaches. Eastern Europe, they were called kulaks. It was making reference to animals. It's always something that is dehumanizing. And whenever we see discourse that dehumanizes a group of people, we see political action that dehumanizes a group of people, we should get very worried, and we should start trying to do something about it.
I also want to just remind us that even in this country, we said that the slaves, the descendants of slaves that were brought over here were only 3/5 of a human. So that was like some partial dehumanization that was going
them from
on.
From the so-called human race, even in the period after the Civil
that's
War.
Right. That's right. Do we have another call?
Yes.
Hello, Essex on the Air.
Yes. Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, thank you for allowing me being in the air. This is a very important thought I would like to address. It's about how people who are the so-called leaders of the world can turn a natural disaster into a genocide. We can see throughout this decade, we have seen many dirty faces of politics. We have heard them on the radio and television. But the truth is that when we have elected people into office, we have an obligation when they don't do what they promise to do in terms of serving the people, we have also the right to ask them to be brought down. The truth is, when you take an oath to uphold an office, you have a moral and civil obligation to God and the people you promise to serve. And when you don't do what you're supposed to do, where are the people? We have become so desensitized, and then because of the crime that are perpetrated in the lives of personal and public lives.
This is a very, very, very important thought that you have, and it certainly tells us that we're going to have to have another discussion about this. This is, we're getting to the end of our show, and I want to let our audience know, I want to thank very much Tibby Gallus, and also to let the audience know that you've been listening to Ethics on the Air on WBAI 99.5 FM and streaming live at WBAI.org. with Dr. Phyllis Harrison Ross and Dr. Terry Perelin from the New York Society for Ethical Culture, here today with Tibby Gallus, Dr. Tibby Gallus, the Managing Director of the Auschwitz Institute for Peace and Reconciliation. We want to thank our engineer, Ife Dancy, and Kathy Davis here at WBAI. The New York Society for Ethical Culture invites you to join us at our Sunday platforms and our Sunday schools, where we teach ethical living to our children, 1115 a.m. to West 64th Street on Sundays in Manhattan. Check our website, nysec.org, for information on other events and societies in this region and in the U.S. Check with the American Ethical Union at aeu.org. And remember to support WBAIFM and .org. And thanks for listening.
Thank you very much for this chance. And do also visit our website, www.auschwitzinstitute.org. Cheers.
Tune in to listener-supported WBAI 99.5 FM, your Peace and Justice radio station. Coming up at noon, take charge of your health right here on your listener-supported station. But before that, your community bulletin board.